everyone, and welcome to this, the debut edition of Beyond Nitro here on adfreeshows.com. My name is Guy Evans, and you may remember me, in the words of Troy McClure, from such books as Nitro, The Incredible Rise and Inevitable Collapse of Ted Turner's WCW, and of course Grateful, the book that I was very privileged to co-author with Eric Bischoff. And speaking of being privileged, it is very much a privilege to be with you here today. I want to thank Conrad Thompson and Evan Polisher in particular for this opportunity. And I want to talk a little bit about how this all came to be and what to expect beyond the first episode of Beyond Nitro, if that makes sense. So I want to tell you a little bit about the vision and what we have in mind here and how we see you guys becoming an integral part of the show. But first, let me backtrack a couple of months ago to when Evan and I first started talking about some of the offerings on adfreeshows.com and, you know, had a conversation about just the amazing variety of programming on there. And I said to Evan, you know, have you considered adding, for lack of a better word, a literary component to the site, having some sort of written feature that people can maybe get into on a monthly basis? And that was the origin of this idea. It was taking some of the elements and themes and stories of the Nitro book and putting a magnifying glass over certain things that maybe because of time constraints or the inherent limitations of doing a book, you know, I wasn't able to go into as much detail as perhaps I would have liked to, and maybe turning some of those things into a monthly feature just for you guys. And, you know, thankfully, Evan really liked the idea, and, you know, that sort of led to us talking about adding an audio component to this for people who perhaps, you know, don't have the time or the inclination to go through the entire article. And so as a result of those conversations, that's what we're presenting to you today. Later on, after my preamble is over here, what I'm going to do is give you the narration of this month's feature, which is all about the topic of nostalgia, which fits very nicely with this platform, doesn't it? You know, it's something that I've been keenly interested in for quite some time. Why is it that the nostalgia around the Monday Night Wars has persisted for so long? You could take sort of a reductivist view and you could say, well, it's kind of just the natural boomerang effect of, hey, it's been 20 plus years. People are at a point in their life now where maybe they have the inclination to go back and revisit some of the important things from their childhood, their adolescence, their young adulthood, so on and so forth. That could kind of be the end of the conversation, right? That's logical to think that way. And I think there's some validity to that. But I've often thought that actually there's a lot more to it. And that's kind of the theme of this month's piece, is talking about, okay, first of all, what is the basis of nostalgia? Where do we see it sort of creeping into other forms of entertainment? Where do we see it being a force in a lot of the content that we digest today? What has been the role of nostalgia in professional wrestling? And moreover, and more importantly, what explains the sort of hyper focus on a particular time period, that being the Monday Night Wars? And so hopefully by the time I narrate that entire piece, you'll have some things to think about and give me some feedback on, which in turn will help next month's episode. So in other words, that's what's to come later on in this particular episode. I'm going to give you my narration of this month's piece. And again, you're going to have the option on a monthly basis to read the thing, or you can listen to this. I mean, if you check out this audio version of the show, I dare say you're probably going to get a little bit more content than simply reading the article. But the vision that we have for this down the road, and what's kind of cool about this, is I guarantee whatever it is that I say now, it's going to change and evolve and probably become much better as a result of your guys' feedback. But where we kind of see this going is incorporating a video element at some point. So perhaps it may be the case that one month, rather than tackling a very general, wide-ranging topic such as the role of nostalgia in professional wrestling and or the continued appeal of the Monday Night Wars, for which a 500-part podcast series could be produced on that. Rather than doing that, you guys might say, you know what, actually, Guy, I'd rather you go hyper-specific on one particular aspect of this time period. So in other words, I would really like you to go out there and research the production of the various WWF promo videos and pay-per-view teasers and all of that kind of stuff that, that they incorporated on their programming. How about you spend the next month, Guy, go and talk to a bunch of people, do your interviews, do your research, and come back and present us a piece on that. And I'd be happy to do that. So some months it may be very, very specific. It may be specifically tailored towards a particular part of, you know, that time period. You know, there may be some of you that might say, you know what, I'm actually more of a fan of the Hulkamania era, and I'd like to hear some more stuff about the 80s. You know, some of you may want to have some content about the early 2000s. I mean, I'm wide open, and I'm definitely receptive to all of that. But I will say, by virtue of, you know, the Nitro book existing, my wheelhouse, so to speak, is probably that 95 to 01 time frame. And that's probably a good place to start. Let's put it that way. And so, you know, what may happen down the road is we may take one of the principal characters, so to speak, or people who are mentioned in the article, and we may, you know, do an interview with them, and that could be part of the show. The format that Evan and I have talked about is maybe something like the following, where show opens up, we go over your guys' feedback, answer some questions, get into the narration of that particular month's piece, and then finish up with an interview, as I said, involving someone who was mentioned in that piece, who was integral to the feature for that month. And then beyond that, we've also thought about, you know, if we have a topic that is especially gaining a lot of traction and has generated a lot of discussion, maybe setting up a Zoom call where we can all get on there and again bring someone who was mentioned in the article to be part of the discussion and talk about it even further. What I'm trying to get across to you is this is very much going to be something that evolves and changes based on your guys' feedback. And I'm excited about that. And I don't personally like being locked into doing the same thing every single month. You know, as a consumer and also as a creator, so to speak, I like to have the freedom to do different things. And when we get to the narration of this month's piece, I think you're going to see that as well in terms of what's in this article, a little bit of a personal story, a little bit of a look back from a psychological point of view, as to what is it, generally speaking, about nostalgia that speaks to us as human beings. Specific focus on, you know, Monday Night Wars nostalgia, and I've adapted some of the content from the expanded Nitro book in order to do that. And so you're going to get a little bit of everything, you know, in this month's piece. But before we get there, before we get to the narration, and before I stop speaking extemporaneously and start narrating my own piece, I want to give you some general thoughts that I have in relation to this topic, which I think would be helpful because it kind of gives you some insight into where I'm coming from on all of this stuff. So as I mentioned before, I think you can reduce this kind of discussion to a very basic level and simply make the argument that, well, you know, we see across society all of the time these kind of retro movements, right? And they seem to occur almost on kind of a metronomic basis. So the peak of 60s nostalgia, for example, it's generally acknowledged that that occurred in the 80s. And actually, we could really go into the weeds here, but there are some accounts that will even narrow it down to a very specific time frame and say 1982 to 1989, for example. There's a journalist, Tom Vanderbilt, who talked about that. And then, you know, the early 90s, there was sort of a wave of 70s nostalgia, and we can debate the extent to which, you know, the media either capitalized on that or perhaps even to some degree created it in the first place, because obviously there are some incentives associated with bringing back, you know, trends from the past, probably beyond the scope of what we have time to cover today. But the general principle there is that given enough time, it does appear almost on a cyclical kind of basis that what has become popular in the past, like a sort of a boomerang effect, will come back around and be popular again. But when it comes to this subject, I don't think it's as simple as that. I think you could make the argument, technically speaking, that the nostalgia over the mid to late 90s era of wrestling, and particularly the intensity of it, arguably should have elapsed by now. And I think you've seen various waves of it, certainly over the years. If you think back to the first few years after WCW shut down. Of course, you had the documentary produced by WWE in 2004 and some of the autobiographical accounts coming out around that time and early books about the WCW subject and the Monday Night Wars in general. There was kind of a sense at that point, okay, everything that possibly could have been said about this topic has been said. There's no new ground to explore. No stone is out there that hasn't been uncovered. Let's just kind of move on and not talk about it again. And, you know, what's interesting is it came back. You know, you think about the boom in, you know, vintage wrestling podcasts that have happened over the last 10 years, many of which focused around a very specific time frame. You think about the recent announcement that there's going to be, you know, a television event based around telling the story of WCW's, you know, rise and fall, but this time taking a much more informed and well-rounded approach to it. The fact that AEW, you know, regardless of its relative successes or failures, I would argue is destined to always be compared to what many of us hold as a reference point, which is that mid to late 90s era of wrestling. I think that's the way that naturally we evaluate and ascertain the extent to which something is working is we have to compare it to something. And for many of us, that something is the time in which, you know, wrestling was truly mainstream and was on fire and both companies were clicking on all cylinders. I know that's sort of the lens through which I see modern wrestling as well. So again, I think you could argue that 23 years after the fact, and arguably 25 years since the peak of the wars, the sheer intensity of that nostalgia probably, according to conventional wisdom, let's say, probably should have passed by now. But why hasn't it? Well, simply put, you're going to have to listen to the narration coming up here if you haven't read the piece to find out the answer to that. Very much welcome your guys' feedback and comments for next time. And I'm going to leave it there for this preamble here. I want to let the article speak for itself and look forward to hearing what you guys think. You can send me a message at Guy Evans Books. Of course, loop ad-free shows into it as well. But in the meantime, sit back, relax, and enjoy this, the first feature in the new Beyond Nitro series. There is no next. Nostalgia, the Monday Night Wars, and wrestling's elusive boom period. Part 1. A Curious Encounter. Ahead is kind of a darkened path. Behind is all lit up. But it's where we've been. Phil Jackson. Behold, exclaimed the industry veteran, pausing for dramatic effect. The king of circular logic lives among us. It was around this time, I noticed, that his words were taking on a theatrical flair. We may have been sitting in a dimly lit alehouse, but for all intents and purposes, it may as well have been Madison Square Garden. What started as an interview had devolved into an old-school battle of wits, and apparently, we were going Broadway. Look, I clarified, you know it's not necessarily my viewpoint, but it's an argument that's out there. An argument, he repeated, that's out there. Out where? Before I could respond, the old pro erupted in laughter. I'm just fucking with you, he said. I know you're just doing your job, but run it by me one more time. I'll try to give you an answer that's fit to print. Well, I said, there are those in your business, the business of pro wrestling, who claim that the industry has significantly evolved. They say, changed, he interjected. The industry has changed. No, I replied. They say the modern style of wrestling, in comparison to generations past, is more sophisticated, more polished, more, I don't know, evolved. They say guys today are doing things the old-timers couldn't dream about. Couldn't dream about, he mumbled to himself, rocking in his chair a little, considering whether to engage with the notion further. Forget all that, he said quickly, thinking better of it, interrupting himself in the process. This is what I mean by circular logic, he said. So in a nutshell, the argument is, whatever is newer is by definition better. Modern wrestling is newer, therefore modern wrestling is better. Did I get that right? I wouldn't say it's that straightforward, I said. But do they have a point, though? Things are on an upswing right now. It's like one of your great co-workers used to say, right? Business is starting to pick up. Well, yeah, he shrugged, calling for another drink in swift succession. I mean, based on what these guys have been doing for the last 20 years, there's been nowhere to go but up, so... Before long, as was occurring frequently throughout our interview, two patrons stopped by with a familiar request. Sure thing, guys, granted the veteran, deftly positioning himself for a photo. Appreciate your support. I used to love watching you on TV, beamed one of the patrons, happily checking the image on his smartphone. It means a lot, thank you. All right, sighed the veteran, slowly returning to his seat. Look, he continued, snapping back into the conversation. Fuck whatever I was just telling you. Here's the deal. Do you see that guy's iPhone? Yeah, I nodded, noting his reference to the fan just departed. People think, began the former wrestler, operating now like the consummate pro, adapting on the fly, going with whatever there was to work with. People think, he repeated, that just because we have that fucking supercomputer in our pocket, everything is so much better than back in the day. Am I right? Maybe, I replied, to a degree. Well, here's what I know from my degree, he said. The degree I got from working in the pro wrestling business, 30 plus years. I'm just going to be honest with you. They might say we couldn't do what they do now, but guess what? They couldn't do what we did back then either. Our ship was just better. That's number one, he emphasized. That's why I'm still getting picture requests, and the guys you see on TV today are on the side of a milk carton. We weren't diving all over each other like Cirque du Soleil. There was a reality to what we did out there. Number two, he continued, becoming ever more animated. Have you heard of the expression, Father Time is undefeated? Sure, I responded. Okay, he said. Well, here's another one for you. Nostalgia has the longest win streak of them all, brother.
Part 2. The Basis of Nostalgia.
The tendency of human beings to engage in nostalgia, taken from the Greek word nostos, or the feeling of returning home, is hardly a new development. At one level of analysis, a certain temporal inevitability, it could be argued, appears rather inherent to the process. In other words, provided that enough time has elapsed between a given stimulus, i.e. the event, place, or time period provoking nostalgia in the first place, and the corresponding response, i.e. the reminiscence of such occurrences, albeit through a present-day lens, almost anything can fall subject to the oft-cited refrain. That which is old eventually becomes new again. In general, there seems to exist a certain rhythm to nostalgia, an inescapable cycle dictating its lifespan. In the world of fashion, for example, the existence of Laver's Law, so named after the British historian James Laver, predicts how various clothing trends, as measured in sales volume, experience the same chronological stages: introduction, acceptance, rejection, and ultimately, reintroduction. 10 years before its time, wrote Laver in his 1937 book, Taste and Fashion, a fashion is indecent. 10 years after, it is hideous, but a century after, it is romantic. But before the expansion of advanced telecommunication mediums, such as television, the development of robust archival solutions, and later, technological innovations such as the internet, nostalgia was mostly understood, as per the German scholar Tobias Becker, as mostly a mental state resembling its original Greek meaning, homesickness. Famously, these historical roots of nostalgia, in addition to its emotional basis and modern-day manifestations, were exploited masterfully in Mad Men, AMC's period drama depicting a 60s-era ad agency. Nostalgia, begins Don Draper, the series protagonist, in a presentation to executives from the Eastman Kodak Company, literally means the pain from an old wound. It's a twinge in your heart, far more powerful than memory alone. Tasked with marketing its new slide projector device, Draper attaches a sentimental value to Kodak's invention. This device, he continues, rotating wistfully through a collection of old family photos, isn't a spaceship, it's a time machine.
It goes backwards and forwards. It takes us to a place where we ache to go again. In modern times, the significance of an innovation such as slide photography, as demonstrated in the episode of Mad Men, now seems to be a rather quaint footnote from history. After all, the tools made possible via the digital revolution, including most notably the ability to reliably record, disseminate, and even recontextualize events ad infinitum, have since introduced a deeper dimension to nostalgia. It is perhaps this change that explains, in part, the increasing prevalence of nostalgic elements in our popular culture. In 1981, for example, only 16% of the year's most popular movies were sequels, spin-offs, or remakes. By 2019, however, this percentage rose to exceed 80%. Similarly, so-called old songs, defined as such by MRC Data, a music analytics firm, currently make up 7/10 of the US music market. The new music market is actually shrinking, summarized one piece in The Atlantic. All the growth in the market is coming from old songs. Moreover, a cursory glance at the lineup for the latest Super Bowl halftime shows, with few exceptions granted, suggests an overwhelming interest in stars made famous during an earlier time. The 2022 edition of the show, for example, featured rappers Snoop Dogg, born during the Nixon administration, and Dr. Dre, just days away from turning 57. A similar emphasis on the past can be observed across a number of entertainment genres, including, admittedly, a spectacle for which there is no obvious analog, professional wrestling. Part 3, The Next Round. How about this? Back in the bar, I was starting to enjoy playing the role of spoiler. How about this? The biggest year in WWE history, I said, reading aloud from my phone. Highest social media views ever. Highest merchandise revenue ever. Highest sponsorship revenue ever. Highest premium live event viewership ever. Highest grossing ticket sales ever. Interesting metrics, grizzled the old pro, his sarcasm practically dripping from the table. Well, financially, they're definitely on fire, I said, resuming my contrarian character. I mean, is this not the next wrestling boom we've been promised for how many years now? Nope, he responded. Why not? I asked. There is no next, he declared matter-of-factly. That horse left the barn a long time ago. So you're saying, I surmised, that regardless of how much money the industry leader makes, it can never surpass its own history? You're saying that a boom period is about, what, cultural relevance, mainstream popularity? Sure, all those words you just said, smiled the seasoned grappler. I mean, is what we see now anything like the Attitude Era? How it was in the 90s? Look, I'm not saying that wrestling won't be that big again. I'm saying it can't be. Part 4, Anatomy of a Boom. The history of wrestling, in the United States especially, offers the record of various boom periods, or sustained peaks in fan interest, followed by periods of relative disinterest. These cycles emerge, it has long been theorized, in concert with various external trends, including advancements in technology, cultural shifts, and contemporary socio-economic factors. The expansion of Vince McMahon's World Wrestling Federation, or WWF, for example, in the mid to late 1980s specifically, accompanied the rapid growth of cable television and pay-per-view. Moreover, the WWF boom, fundamentally built around the larger-than-life personas of Hulk Hogan, Rowdy Roddy Piper, and Macho Man Randy Savage, occurred at a time in which action movies, in terms of production frequency, peaked as a movie genre. G.I. Joe and He-Man figures flew off the shelves. Rock songs like Born in the USA garnered heavy rotation on radio and MTV, the latter of which was brilliantly exploited, incidentally, via McMahon's own rock and wrestling campaign. Similarly, the culturally conservative tone of WWF programming, with Hogan, its patriotic protagonist, defending the quote American way, resonated to viewers in 1984, the purported summertime of American resurgence, in a manner that would be parodied only a generation later. Enveloping it all, of course, was an economic resurgence, deficit spending aside,
bolstered by high growth, low inflation rates, and full employment. Personal disposable income, for which the entertainment business, including pro wrestling, relies, rose upwards throughout the decade. A decade later, the boom initiated via the Monday Night Wars, the famous head-to-head ratings competition between McMahon's WWF and Ted Turner's World Championship Wrestling, or WCW, also benefited from a number of extraneous conditions. While primarily the era derived its appeal from an unprecedented array of superstar talent, innovative storylines, creative production methods, and, above all else, the competition itself, a variety of external elements acted, as if through force multiplication, to amplify the reach of wrestling further. To a host of old-school fans, the corresponding time period, 1995 to 2001, represents a number of themes which transcend its subject matter, notably the rise of early internet culture, the still active notion of mainstream, the limits of creative expression, edgy entertainment that pushed the envelope, television and its cultural power, including, as a corollary, the decline of the televised communal experience, and the relative tranquility of America's cultural, economic, and political affairs, often described with respect to the Western world generally as an apparent holiday from history. It was in this context that the explosion in wrestling's popularity occurred. The now mostly outdated concept of a common mass culture, achieved partly through popular entertainment, persisted at the turn of the century, and wrestling was perfect for it. The twists and turns of each broadcast, very often consumed on a communal basis, provided much fodder for the cliched but very real water cooler conversations on Tuesday mornings. In part because of the unifying power of television, as well as the presentation of the genre itself, wrestling fans could commonly be expected to follow other, quote, legitimate sports, and vice versa. A cursory glance at an old Nitro episode offers an archive of fans acting more like spectators at a sporting event, and less like critics judging a performance on its artistic merits. For the television viewer, there existed something tangible about tuning in at the same exact time as millions of others, and, with no smartphones in sight, being entertained without distraction. Wrestling was at once both ephemeral and memorable, with as much attention focused on moments as the actual matches themselves. With the convergence of the analog and digital worlds not yet underway, at least to any appreciable degree, attendance at shows meant an inability, by definition, to solicit reactions from those not in the physical environment. To that end, the importance of each turn, toehold, and tap-out was heightened immensely. Furthermore, it is likely no small coincidence that wrestling's ascendance, alongside an enhanced public appetite for violence, sex, and spectacle, occurred at a time of peace and prosperity. Increasingly throughout the 1990s, and particularly as the year 2000 grew ever closer, America enjoyed, quote, so much good news, remembered Kurt Anderson in the New York Times, that each astounding achievement didn't even register. In America, offered Tom Brokaw in contemporaneous comments, lamenting the soaring popularity of WWF and WCW, people are so switched off of politics right now. Times are so good. We have the highest level of prosperity in our history, probably in the history of Western civilization, so people can be kind of disengaged from real things. Popular television, film, and music offerings of the time were littered with futuristic illusions. A common marketing tactic, later to be parodied due to its omnipresence, was to attach the label of 2000 to a supposedly improved product or service. But once the 2000s actually arrived, with the new millennium technically beginning on January 1, 2001, the so-called long 90s continued to march on unabated. Undergirding the look, feel, and tenor of much of the cultural output was the following unspoken assumption: things can only get better. Generalizations aside, that is hardly the sentiment today. Ultimately, the ratings battle officially ended on March 26, 2001, but for a while thereafter, the WWF continued to treat its programming with a noticeable sense of urgency, almost as if it remained in competition with the now-defunct WCW. Over time, however, its viewership began an almost metronomic decline. Bereft of true competition, attempts to manufacture versions of such were legion, culminating after the short-lived WCW Invasion, and later a reboot of the NWO, in an artificial split of the WWF roster. Concurrently, the company attempted to stabilize following a series of dizzying blows, the departure of several top stars, including most notably Stone Cold Steve Austin and The Rock, a forced rebranding as World Wrestling Entertainment, or WWE, the result of a legal loss to the World Wildlife Fund, and the eventual rise of mixed martial arts, with the Ultimate Fighting Championship, or UFC, becoming the leading provider of pay-per-view television. The great 90s epic continued to cast a long shadow over the industry. It would soon become cliche for fans, promoters, and wrestlers alike to ponder the ever-present conundrum. Where did all those people, the WCW fans, actually go? In truth, many millions had simply moved on. In particular, those drawn to wrestling during the second half of the boom, when the onus to shock viewers became more prevalent, found, on the rapidly growing internet, a seemingly endless source of new entertainment options. Whereas the WWF, in particular, once found success in bending the rules, relative to both modern sensibilities and convention, the virtual world developed as a relative free-for-all. For all of its hilarity and hijinks, after all, wrestling programs only ever went so far. An evident fact for those more into stunts over suplexes, carnage over chokeslams. Gradually, in time, WWE began moving towards a more family-friendly format, and remarkably, the strategic shift to the PG era would prove to be highly lucrative, with the company weathering a steady decline to its mainstream relevancy, popularity, and cultural appeal, going on to achieve a doubling of revenues between 2007, $486 million, and 2020. $974 million. Ironically, whereas wrestling had once been a tough sell for advertisers, the sanitized version of sports entertainment, benefiting from its status as live entertainment in an era of cord cutting, suddenly commanded astronomical rights fees from television networks, including close to $300 million per year for Monday Night Raw alone. Moreover, following the launch of the WWE Network, a subscription-based video-on-demand service in 2014, the need to expand the fanbase diminished further. Therefore, with regard to the current state of the professional wrestling industry, it is possible to highlight the following two truisms. A. Professional wrestling is today a more profitable enterprise than ever. And B. Professional wrestling is today less popular and/or culturally relevant than ever. I've often been asked, stated former WCW president Eric Bischoff in his second book, Grateful, why there seems to be a seemingly insatiable appetite on the part of the wrestling fan for discussions about the mid to late 90s era of wrestling. There are two components at play, I think. First, wrestling fans, unlike fans of any other sport or spectacle, are probably the most loyal fans in mainstream entertainment. Secondly, if you think about those fans, they were likely somewhere around their teens, and therefore were at their most impressionable, when the kind of wrestling that was being produced at that time took place. To them, it will never get better than what it was at that time of their lives, no matter if somebody in the wrestling industry develops a magic formula that completely transcends the industry, or even if everything was peaking from a creative point of view today. Those people are so loyal to that time period, there's probably a symbiotic relationship between their loyalty and their age, that they just won't be impressed as much as they were in their teens. Between the fact that wrestling fans are so loyal, and the fact that their adolescence coincided with such an amazing period of time in pro wrestling, it had a profound impact on tens of millions of young people. They love listening to stories about that era, especially from the people who were instrumental in making it happen. In some respects, they're reliving their childhood all over again. Furthermore, their kids now have the opportunity to become fans of that era, due to innovations like the WWE Network and now the content hosted on Peacock. There's such a massive audience for content dissecting that time period, and so many of the key figures from that time are still active today. These factors amount to the Monday Night Wars being remembered as being an even bigger deal than it actually was, and it was a big frickin' deal. On one hand, it has long been considered a matter of faith. Wrestling fans love nostalgia. The return of various legends to WWE's Royal Rumble event is considered a yearly highlight. The use of archival footage serves, quite often, as a powerful means of furthering a white-hot feud. The promotion of an upcoming retirement match, while largely a contradiction in terms, who's kidding who, there'll always be one more match, almost guarantees at least some uptick in business. However, despite wrestling fans' well-established affectation towards the past, the life cycle of Monday Night War's nostalgia, no time in wrestling history has been dissected, discussed, and debated more thoroughly, seemed to have reached its conclusion in 2014, specifically upon the release of a titular WWE documentary series, itself a cornerstone of the company's new streaming platform. It was a sentiment echoed by the content of WrestleMania the following spring, with one match, Sting vs. Triple H, functioning as a proxy for the competition all over again. "We saw the Monday Night Wars come to life," stated John Bradshaw Layfield famously from the commentary booth, "and the right side won again." Subsequently, though, an unexpected dynamic occurred. Nostalgia was born anew, a multi-year expansion in vintage wrestling podcasts, powered in large part by an overwhelming focus on its most iconic era, first began and then continued relatively unabated. Incredibly, some shows, including 83 Weeks, for example, have now persisted for longer than the entire WWF-WCW conflict. The recent announcement of a WCW-focused television event, set to run in 2024, some 23 years after WCW was sold to its competitor, lends further credence to that end. Most notable, perhaps, is the plight of All Elite Wrestling, an outfit which appears destined, regardless of its ultimate viability, to be judged on a scale not of its own making. According to one viewpoint, at least, the allure of 90s-focused wrestling retrospectives should have declined by now, at least when considering, historically speaking, the way in which the industry treated its transition between eras. In the mid to late 90s, relatively few fans were looking wistfully at the quote, good old days of 1972. Conversely, it could be argued that today, the 90s and everything it symbolizes remains a formidable incumbent, the measuring stick against which all is compared.
Part 5. Last Call.
To coin a phrase, we had just gotten the go-home, the bar was almost empty, and the conversation complete. "All right," I said, "I appreciate the time, you've given me a whole lot to think about." "Well," shrugged the old pro, gritting his teeth as we stepped outside, "just don't attach me to this one. I'm too old for the pissants on TikTok or whatever." "Of course," I said, "so I guess we'll do the book interview next time?" "Hey, what did I tell you?" he joked. "There is no next." "Nice," I said. "That nostalgia line earlier was pretty good too." A cab pulled up as we began to part ways. "Going uptown, my favorite place in the world," said the ex-wrestler, pointing to the address on his room key. "That's downtown," replied the driver. "Soho Grand." "Ah," growled the veteran, gently knocking the side of his head. "I guess nostalgia just ain't what it used to be."